the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou katoa. I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we're going to analyse how leaders of the G7, NATO and EU this week juxtaposition behind the United States to form a multilateral consensus pact. The move occurred immediately prior to the Joe Biden-Vladimir Putin summit. And after the US and Russia presidential summit, the United States President Joe Biden said to media in an impromptu stand-up that he owed the G7, EU and NATO leaders a debt of gratitude. He added that their support made a difference and that he, that is Biden, but also significantly Vladimir Putin, knew he was representing a powerful global bloc at the US-Russia summit. Now, Biden added too that the US was again accepted as the leader of Western nations. But with that group, that grouping of the world's strongest countries, creating this kind of consensus pact, where does that leave small and regional powers like New Zealand and Australia, and many within the Indo-Asia-Pacific region? And was the US-Russia summit a significant moment, aiding stability in the world, and how will China react to this? Okay, we're going to join with Paul, who's waiting online. We're going to discuss all of these issues and more. Let's cross to Paul right now. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too. Paul, let's pick up on these the series of high-powered meetings that have taken place up in Europe, significantly in Geneva overnight with Vladimir Putin of Russia and also the President of the United States, Joe Biden. But significantly, like I said in the introduction, this week has been filled with significant moments. The G7 meeting where Joe Biden presented there as well, that was held in Britain, of course. Britain was the host. But then you've got the NATO meetings as well, and also significantly too, the EU leaders, which seem to be the trifecta of meetings that gave the petrol into the engine of the US machine as they went into this significant US-Russian summit, Paul. So that's the roundup of it. What do you make of this? How do you start to analyse the complexities within this and unpack it, Paul?
Well, let's start with the good news. You know, the good news is that Biden delivered on a promise to the international community that the US would return to multilateralism. It would re-engage not only with, you know, the global community, but most importantly with the community of Western liberal democracies. And this was its first trip abroad, so the symbolic significance of this is not lost on anybody. And he started with the G7, which is a community of advanced liberal democracies. So he's pushing that democratic capitalist line. And in it, what was interesting was two things were reaffirmed. On a positive note, what was reaffirmed was the commitment of the West to democratic values. Now, you and I both know that we often fail to achieve our ideals, but they reaffirmed the ideals. On human rights, on transparency, on all those sort of things. That was good. Less good, depending on, you know, how you look at it, is that they reaffirmed also their concern about the People's Republic of China. Mm. By that, what I mean is they pose themselves antithetically to the Chinese, as the Chinese being autocratic, not playing by the international rules, being somewhat rogue in their behavior, versus liberal democracies. Now, again, you and I could comment forever on whether or not the United States has behaved, properly or improperly in global affairs.
Yeah, we could dig into the hypocrisy of such as what you're saying there. Yeah,
yeah. But they reaffirmed this. Okay, so there's good, and then there's some concerns because again, you're posing this bloc against another entity outside the bloc, and I'll get into that a little bit more in a second. Then they go to NATO. Now, the G7 are liberal democracies. And incidentally, they invited Australia over as an observer, as an invited guest. And I think two things were happening. As you well know, many of these multilateral meetings are interesting because of the bilateral along, you know, on the sideline. And one of those was Boris Johnson inking a trade deal with Prime Minister Scott Morrison of Australia, the first trade deal that the UK has signed after Brexit.
It went albeit it takes 15 years to really get the wheels moving on it, but it's significant, isn't it?
Significant. It shows at least the Australians have confidence that Britain will be able to stand alone and replace its relationship with the EU with, you know, a number of bilateral relationships with other countries. And I think it's a precursor to the Australians being invited to join the G7, that it's going to turn into a G8 with Australia as an upcoming power that is liberal democratic. You know,
and that reflects some of the things that we've discussed with respect to Australia, its own ambitions relating to becoming a regional power, but also from the point of view of what common ground interests and advantages does that present for its closest allies, meaning the United States, Britain, and others within the pact, like Canada and, yeah, New Zealand too.
Just think in terms of strategic alignment. You know, all of these northern liberal democracies now getting a partner in the South that is both economic as well as military, and the partnership is formalized. So there's strategic advantages to be accrued, but then again, the Australians are counterpoising themselves against the People's Republic of China. So in a weird way, it's a defensive alliance of democracies in the face of what they say is an autocratic threat. Now, turning to threat mitigation, then Joe Biden went to Brussels to the NATO headquarters. And what was fascinating about that was that the Secretary General of NATO was incredibly hawkish when it came not only to the Chinese, who he basically said are a threat on a global scale, but also on the Russians. Now, we have to remember that NATO was created as an anti-Soviet alliance. And the Russians have come back to be, you know, the old is the new bogeyman, to which can be added the People's Republic of China. Incredibly hawkish speech. I mean, let's just say it was much less than diplomatic. And NATO is not a community of democracies. Let's think, for example, Turkey is a NATO member. Hungary is much less than democratic these days, as is Poland. So they are Western European countries, some original members, some added in, like Hungary, after the end of the Cold War, but they are a defensive Western alliance. And even Turkey remained quiet on the issue of the Chinese and the Russians, even though it has very good relations with both China and Russia when it comes particularly to military affairs. Then Biden goes to the EU, which is by charter a community of democracies. You have to have fair and open elections. You have to be a signatory of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all these sort of things in order to join the EU.
And the EU nations themselves, it seems from afar, have been struggling to actually get some sort of leverage or influence over forcing Russia to back off some of the things that are negatively impacting on their peoples or their region. I'm talking about Ukraine, for example, you know, all of these others, the concerns relating to Crimea, Belarus, and all of these big issues that are presenting there. And it's almost like the EU has been toothless beyond being, you know, a sanction block or being able to impact on the purse strings or the coffers, if you like, of Russia. And it seems like they really needed the United States to return back into some leadership role, Paul. Am I reading this right?
You are. But it's interesting how this has been parceled out. The G7 is a political grouping. NATO is a military grouping. The EU is an economic grouping. So they agreed to economic issues like how to pursue the Nord Stream 2 project, which has been controversial in many circles. They agreed to a vaccination rollout program, which, if less than ambitious, they wanted to vaccinate 10% of the world's population by the end of the year. You know, that's that, and even that may be aspirational, but they put their heads together on that. So if you think about it, Biden aligned all the ducks in a row. He got the political consensus, and that phrase consensus pack is excellent, because that was, this was about to show the Chinese and the Russians. No, good turn of phrase, mate, because you're showing the Russians and the Chinese a united front. You're saying politically, militarily, economically, we have you in our sights. We don't want, you know, we don't want hostilities, but we see you as a threat, and we will respond in a unified way now that the United States has come back. And in the case of both NATO and the EU, given those organizations some teeth, because the economics of the United States are very important to the EU. So that set up the meeting with Putin. You know, that was the big, you know, the press was really focused on what, I'd hate to say it, but many of them may have wished was a confrontation. You know,
Was it successful in being able to tame this absolutely shrewd character, former spy, former significant mover in the KGB, moves into this position in Russian Federation in its infancy after, you know, Boris Yeltsin vacates the position? He's been around a long time and has obviously got a reputation of being a smooth, shrewd, cunning operator. Is this block, is this consensus pact, if we put it in that respect, is it enough to actually tame what we have been seeing as a more ambitious, influential, with respect to the satellite states type of entity that the Russian Federation has become?
Well, I think it helped a lot on two fronts. I mean, the Russians, you know, had to look over and say, okay, what, you know, is he going to be able to unify the Europeans? Is the Trump era truly over? You know, is there weakness in this alliance system, in these blocks that we can exploit? So they were observing this very closely. And I think the message back to them is the United States is back and the Europeans are united with it. I won't say behind it, because the U.S. is not in the leadership role, but that's exactly what Putin wanted to see. Is he going to go back and reclaim the seat at the head of the table, as Biden himself has said he would, or is he going to sit down in the middle of the table and he'll still be the first amongst equals, but you know, he's no longer sitting at the top calling the shots? I actually think that my opinion is that he's sitting in the middle of the table, because some of the things that Trump did will be very difficult to undo over the short term.
I think on that point too, just sorry to interrupt, but I think you're absolutely right there in this sense that Biden became the envoy of that pact, that consensus block. So that suggests that he is not cracking the whip, as we would say here. He is basically the envoy of it. So therefore, it is and by way of consensus, well, that suggests that he's a part of a team. He may be the captain of the team, but it's at the behest of those other nations. So the analysis of which, you know, you led on these previous episodes of A View from Afar, I think, in my view, has positioned the United States exactly correctly. And it's not that global superpower that is dictating to other nations what they must do, but it's a Biden-style team approach. I'm interested to see what you think of that from the point of view of the regional and smaller powers, but we can get to that halfway through the episode. But from the point of view of what is Putin's next move, how do you see this cunning operator actually responding to this US-Russia summit outcome?
Okay, well, just to finish the thought I had on the nature of the move before meeting Putin, you know, again, we agree he's sitting more in the middle of the table. Let's put it this way. The Europeans needed the U.S. to come back to the fold more than the U.S. needed to get back into European affairs. I mean, I as an internationalist, think that the U.S. is safest when it commits itself to the international community and the rule of law and all that sort of stuff. But the Europeans were in a bit of disarray without U.S. leadership. But things have changed. And so they're backing Biden. They're not taking orders from him. And that's why the consensus pact is a very good way to phrase it, because they just found areas to agree on. Again, the problem, and we'll talk about this, is that what they mostly agreed on is that they don't like the Russians and the Chinese for a variety of reasons. And you know, I see problems with that, but I'll leave it for a moment. Now, Putin is looking at all of this because he wants to see if there are fractures in that pact, if there's, you know, disunity, if he can break them apart. And so far, it appears that he'll have a hard time doing so now that they've recommitted themselves to each other. So, you know, what's in it for him to go meet Biden? Well, he has to test Biden's resolve. He has to determine, given U.S. domestic politics, let's face it, at home, things are not well for Biden. I mean, he may be doing good in some areas, but let's face it, the Republicans are essentially a disloyal opposition. We've had an insurrection in the United States. And so Putin wants to, you know, test Biden's mettle and probably wants to know if the reports that Biden is not all there anymore, that he's old, if that's true. And one good way to do that is meet him, look him in the eyes, and talk to him. I
And
should
see
say.
if there's something factoring there, or whether or not it's just simply a Republican spin machine that has sown that into the United States press corps.
Personal meetings are good. Personal meetings are really good for ex-spies and psychological operators like Putin. So he goes in. Now, I should point out, and we've talked about this, both of these leaders have intelligence agencies that have teams of psychologists who prepare the leader about who he's about to meet. And they've met before, but they've both been well prepared as to what to expect. And so there's a bit of a cat and mouse thing going on between the two of them. But what emerges is this: they're going to have areas where they can agree upon climate change. I mean, let's face it, this Siberia has warmed up to the point that we're finding now all sorts of prehistoric animals because the permafrost is melting. The Arctic Ocean is melting, and it's a bit of a free-for-all up there. And the Russians are staking many claims, but let's face it, there are other countries that would like to use the Northern Passage in order to promote trade and that sort of thing. Those are areas where they agree. And so I think
And
what they
concerns about the military or and taking hold and becoming significant in the Arctic Circle areas too, isn't it?
Right. I mean, you want to limit the potential for conflict. I mean, even the Russians do. I mean, you know, we act as if the Russians are irrational, you know, crazed maniac actors. They're nothing of the sort. And so there is the possibility for consensus on a range of policy issues. And I think that both leaders wanted to emphasize to each other that they're going to agree to disagree on certain things, let's say the Ukraine, those sort of things. But on the other hand,
And
at Belarus,
Belarus, yeah.
Apparently the Russians, well, that's one of their red lines. Don't interfere in Belarus. And as we've talked about before, part of Russian geopolitical thought, strategic thought, is to have a buffer zone around the motherland. Belarus factors heavily into that geopolitical thought. So the Americans and the Europeans have to respect that these guys think a lot about buffering in a way that an island country like New Zealand doesn't have to, in a way like a continental country like the United States does not have to.
I was
Okay?
thinking too that with respect to Belarus, I wonder too if that's a card that Putin wants to keep. If there's going to be future negotiations where Russia senses that things are not going its way, and it needs a little bit of currency here in a diplomatic sense, that the Belarus could very well serve its own needs.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I'm not going to say Lukashenko is a puppet of Vladimir Putin, but...
But he's controlled. He wouldn't exist without the support of the Kremlin. Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, Moscow doesn't want to speak by watching Lukashenko get overthrown in a, you know, grassroots revolution. So, you know, they were determined to back him, but he can be quietly removed from the scene. And replaced with someone who's sympathetic to the Russians in a flash. So, you know, I think that they need to explain each other's positions. You know, and Biden's probably saying to Putin, look at your boy, Trump, he's not coming back. He's going to bluster and everything. But certainly on security terms, we've had enough with being nice to you. And so, you know, you got to back off. You got to back off on electoral interference. You got to back off on disinformation and fake news and social media. And you definitely got to back off on this cyber hacking weirdness when it comes to targeting infrastructure, because we know that you cast a blind eye or look the other way when criminal organizations in Russia target U.S. interests. We know that you know. And so just knock it off. Putin will say to him, well, we don't like the fact that you're covertly engaging in sabotage in the Ukraine, that you're trying to undermine us in Belarus, that you're sneaking around in the Middle East now that we've become the preeminent extra-regional power, and you're trying to undermine our positions in the Middle East. You know, we're going to have to do some trade-offs here. And I think that both of these men are very pragmatic. And I think they probably said, okay, on items A through K, we cannot agree. But let's keep things civil, okay? Let's not turn this into a hot conflict. On the other hand, from L to Z, we can agree on those things. You know, we can
That's pretty much the outcome, isn't it? From the point of view of the first meeting, eyeball each other, get a sense of each other at this stage in the game. You know, from Biden's point of view, he had obviously a very firm view that Putin was basically a killer, had no soul, I think was the words he used. From previous meetings, he's president now, so it's a different kind of interaction, isn't it? So all of these kind of things are very interesting. Look, Paul, I'll just pick up on from the point of view of what other media, I'll look at the United States media in this case and just see what they're running. We make comment on how that reportage is going, but also let's get into what's the impact around the world from the point of view of global stability or not, or also the impact and the challenges that present for countries like New Zealand and Australia. Australia's obviously in its ascendancy relating to its pecking order around the world, but other countries in Southeast Asia, Asia Pacific, Indo-Pacific region that interact and have a codependency, not a codependency, a dependency on China trade. So we'll just pick up some of these issues here. Let's just see how it's running in CBS, how they're reporting it in the United States.
President Biden and Russian President Putin held a historic summit in Geneva earlier. It was the first face-to-face meeting between the two world leaders since President Biden took office. The highly anticipated discussions finished in just under 3 hours. Tensions have been high between the two nations in recent years. Russia's recent acts of aggression against Ukraine were at the forefront of today's meeting. President Biden also addressed a recent surge in cyber attacks carried out by Russian hackers and a possible prisoner swap between the two countries. Following the summit, President Putin called the talks productive.
As for the first general appraisal, I think there was no hostility, quite the contrary. Our meeting took place principally speaking, many of our positions, we don't share the same positions in many areas, but I think that both of these sides showed a willingness to understand one another and to find ways to bring our positions closer together. The talks were quite constructive.
Putin says the two countries have agreed to begin negotiations regarding the recent wave of cyber attacks. In addition, both countries will send their ambassadors to their respective posts in Washington and Moscow following the talks.
Paul, we've already covered much of that, but what do you pick up there, the nuance, the mood from Putin, the words or the messages he's choosing to put out there in his response to the summit meeting?
Well, he's basically reaffirming what we just said. I mean, I'll give you a clear example. The START intermediate range agreement, which was in jeopardy under the Trump administration because the Russians had planned to pull out Trump had planned to pull out unless he got certain concessions that the Russians simply would not agree to. Well, they've agreed to those limitations now. I mean, I think when you have two nuclear tip states, those sort of things get resolved fairly quickly because both actors are rational and understand the dangers of nuclear proliferation. Other areas, these gray area phenomena, such as cyber warfare, they're going to have to agree to disagree because, let's be honest, the U.S. plays offense as well as defense. So it's not as if, you know, the Yanks are angelic or the U.K. are angelic and the Russians are the only bad guys in town. It really depends on your perspective. But the key here is that Putin understands times have changed, that this is a time to limit rhetoric, heated rhetoric, and to see what can be worked out in a productive way. I'll just say as an aside before we move to the larger community, there's a line of thought in the United States among strategic analysts that what the Biden administration wants to do is soften and freeze relations with the Russians. Remember, this is a soft power moment. This is not a hard power moment. And by freeze or soften and freeze, what I mean is, let's find the areas of consensus. Let's focus on that. Let's not aggravate each other. And that freezes the relationship in a warm space, to mix metaphors. Why? Because that way the United States can focus its hard power efforts on China. That it's not divided between two potential military threats, that the Western threat has been reduced to a soft power competition, and the harder Eastern threat is dealt with in a more military or more, you know, again, hard power way. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. You know, there's
let's pick up on that because it's an interesting position and point. So we understand, you know, there's the old BRICS kind of arrangement, you know, but significantly amongst those, you know, China and Russia. How does Russia react to the United States and all of its Western consensus pact allies making a competitive move, as it's been said, against the People's Republic of China? Does Russia feel compromised in some way? Does Russia feel on a bound in some way, or even from its own kind of self-interest or its relationship, a bilateral relationship with China, to try and actually make a move on that kind of thing? Or does it sit back and think, it's China's problem, China's big enough and, you know, established enough to deal with such things itself?
Well, the Russians undoubtedly know about this American strategy if it exists. They have good relations, the best relations with the PRC in several decades. They're now engaging in military exercises together. So, you know, the wool is not being pulled over their eyes. But on the other hand, just like the United States has domestic problems, the Russians have domestic issues to consider, and they go beyond the presidency of Vladimir Putin. For example, it's a fossil fuel dependent economy, an economy that's been stretched by the military adventurism in and around the Mediterranean. And so maybe the Russians are a little stretched when it comes to being able to finance and equip their military. And so a freezing of conflict with the West allows them to recharge, direct resources into replenishing their military and resuming their relationship or reforging their relationship with the Chinese, who, as you just said, they're full adults when it comes to the international community. So the Chinese, whether they have allies or not, they can fend for themselves. The important thing here is this. We've been talking about Western multilateral institutions.
Yeah.
But what about non-Western, non-aligned, non-Northern Hemisphere countries?
This is all about the G7, NATO, the EU, the United States, big, powerful countries on the global stage, wrapping a multilateral kind of fence around themselves and saying, this is how it's going to be, fellas. You're friends with us, but we're going to tell you what's going to be happening, meaning telling the subordinates, the small powers like New Zealand, the regional powers like Australia, all the Southeast Asia countries that are aligned for self-interest with trade with China, but also from the point of view of security and stability, require the assistance and perhaps the geopolitical willpower of protection from the United States and the others. So this is it in a nutshell, isn't it? What challenges are there to be overcome by countries like New Zealand, Australia, and the Southeast Asia countries?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that, the Australians clearly have signaled where they, what they're going to do. And it's to rephrase former New Zealand Prime Minister John Key, that's the price of being in the club. The Australians are going to join that G7, NATO. I mean, Australia is a NATO partner, as is New Zealand. There are only three or four countries in the world that are partners of that alliance.
And remember, for the audience's sake, the John Key-led national government of New Zealand, albeit some 5 years ago, 6 years ago, signed up to NATO, particularly in the cybersecurity areas, where there was mutual requirement, mutual dependencies in a sense. So it's very much a formalized thing that Paul's referring to here.
Yeah, and certainly in intelligence. But the Australians have committed to this consensus pact that we've been discussing. But what about other countries? Countries like New Zealand, for example. We're a NATO partner, but we have a independent foreign policy. We don't just rotely, and we're a liberal democracy, who is trade dependent on the Chinese. We've been put between a rock and a hard place.
For a long time.
But this defensive posturing of the G7, NATO, and the EU, all of them, we're trying to negotiate a trade agreement with the EU. We're trying to negotiate a trade agreement, a bilateral, with the UK. They now do this. If we get into further negotiations, what happens if the Chinese say to us, by the way, your prospective partners have all identified us as the bogeyman that needs to be repudiated, to be rejected. That puts New Zealand in a bad place. Now, there are other multilateral forums where small states might be able to balance, and I'm not saying abandon democracy, but forums where some balance can be achieved. And I'll give you the major one.
The G20
is not just about liberal democracies. Both China and Russia are part of it, as is India, very importantly, as is Brazil. And so the G20 is a mixture of authoritarian and democratically ruled countries. They're basically the largest economies and some middle power economies. And they tend to display, they often fracture. The G20 oftentimes fractures when it comes to policy announcements because they simply cannot agree to a consensus. But they often serve as an independent swing vote, if you will, on specific issues in international affairs. Now, in such forums, in a forum like that, or as we've talked about before, in what are known as mini-lateralist or microlateralist forums, where you have a very small number, often of small states, negotiate various policy issues that are of mutual interest, that might be a way of hedging or balancing against what is becoming an increasingly dichotomous, counterpoised bloc. That is, the West portraying itself as democratic, even though it isn't, or it always isn't.
NATO area in particular. Yeah.
In the NATO area, but they're posing themselves as the defenders of a certain, I would say, they're not always Western values, but a certain type of values, let's call them liberal values, but they're counterpoising these blocks against what they call autocracies. I happen to have been a student of authoritarianism, so you know my feelings about Russia and China pretty well. But the point is now you've created a global division. And, you know, the people that are in, the countries that are in the various groupings, they're locked in. But what about the rest of us? I mean, why do we have to be put in a position of picking and choosing, let's say, in the case of New Zealand, countries with whom our values are most closely aligned versus countries who we are dependent on trade? Because we're also dependent on Middle Eastern trade.
So what would be the solution in that? You know, if you're looking at that, and I support this view that you're pitching here. What do you do is, if you can form, once again, through microlateralism, perhaps a consensus block of many countries that become significant because of their arrangements and the consensus? Do you break down the power of the United States-led G7 nations or, you know, the NATO pact by challenging its demands on say, security, intelligence, stability kind of demands? And do you try to break down the economic dependencies that are being expressed and perhaps even elements of demand from a sustainability point of view? Demand meaning you must act in this way coming out of the People's Republic of China. Do you try to break down those power, you know, polarized power positions? Or do you just simply try to find a way through and navigate, keep your head down? You exist, they have to talk to you as some sort of, you know, block, like perhaps the G20 is a good example. What does that look like in real terms, in real geopolitical world global terms?
Well, it's sort of like solving a Rubik's Cube. I think the most important thing is that these groupings, these consensus pacts, cannot demand anything of people who are not inside the pact. That is, you know, they should let their values for themselves, let the, I'll call them independent or non-aligned countries, you know, countries that are not in the G7, NATO, or the EU, to go about their business. And going about their business means one fundamental thing. We must separate hard power conflicts from soft power conflicts. We must separate trade from security affairs. Now, that's where the Rubik's Cube thing comes in, because that's not just about Western partners. It has a lot to do with how the PRC and Russia react to this newly reconstituted alliance structure based on the multilateral principles embedded in the G7, NATO, and the EU. That's going to be a hard one. Not having the pressures of northern partners placed on places like New Zealand will help them take a softly approach to weave their way through these increasingly antagonistic blocks. But I also think that we need a lot more involvement by the Latin Americans and the Africans. I mean, have you noticed, Selwyn, how in all these discussions, and certainly in the media coverage, even down here, and let's remember, we may have been colonized, we may have Western liberal values, but we are of the South. Mm. You know, I mean, I grew up in Latin America, so I tend to think first in North-South terms, then in East-West terms. Well, here's the thing. The big issues of having to choose between this and that and democracy and autocracy, those are not big issues in Latin America or Southern Africa. Now, admittedly, they got troubles with governance galore in both of those regions. But when it comes to their foreign policies, they have been very good. And remember, there's disparate governments all over the place. And we're talking 30 to 40 countries between the two regions. Even with all that disparity of governance, they seem to understand, don't get involved in great power conflicts. You know, keep your powder dry, but most importantly, keep your relationships independent with the various powers and blocks. And so I think that if the North, which is competing against each other, remember, PRC, Russia versus the Europeans and the North Americans, that's
it's all up
com-
there. Yeah.
It's all up. And so if they understand the South, you know, is an object of attention by great powers, a place to be exploited in terms of resources, a place to be manipulated when it comes to politics and diplomacy, but now a place whose relative autonomy has to be respected. Because if not, if you start forcing countries to pick and choose and you use trade dependency, you use security dependency and those sort of things to force an outcome on any given country, two things are going to happen. One is it may backfire, has so often happened in Latin America, where the U.S. put a lot of pressure to have certain type of governments and populations increasingly look to the left as a solution. I mean, those guerrilla movements and revolutions in Latin America did not come out of nowhere, and they weren't, in their first instances, creations of the Soviet Union or China. Those
Many would say, and in my view, correctly so, it was a cause-effect type of situation where the swing toward perhaps anti-American imperialism was a response as opposed to a plan.
You've heard me say this. You know, when I used to go to the States and I'd hear all this anti-communist stuff, I would point to them again, someone who was raised as an Argentine, basically. I'd say, you know what? From my perspective, living in Buenos Aires, I'm not threatened by the Russians or the Chinese. You say they're communists and they're evil. What I'm threatened, everybody else around here is threatened, is by the Yanks. You know, you are the guys who interfere. You are the guys who promote coups. You know, for us, the guerrilla movements, yes, they may get weapons from Soviet bloc countries, but they're a response to your imperialism. They're not the cause.
And of course, you're putting a compelling case here that, you know, when we're talking global affairs and with the G7 and all of this, the voice of South America, Latin American countries, Africa, below the equator line, all of Southeast Asia, that is often very much voiceless. So all of these areas, by number, I think what you're doing is you're putting a compelling logical case forward and saying that microlateralism can actually be a significant player if these countries can find common ground and consensus and present themselves at significant bodies to counter the voice of the demands of the powerful.
Let's put it another way, because you're right. When backed into a corner, maybe southern multilateralism or southern, as in southern hemisphere, microlateralism or minilateralism might be the solutions for the countries in the South. That you organize on a southern hemispheric basis around certain key contentious policy issues, so that you have a voting bloc in the international community that says our concerns is not reducible to East-West conflicts. Our concerns transcend the arguments amongst the North. And so we need to be recognized as independent, autonomous actors who have common interests that are not always shared with our northern neighbors, and try to leverage that into solution sets that may actually contribute to, if not the resolution, the reconciliation of some of the bones of contention or the areas of contention between countries like China on the one hand and the United States on the other. I mean, we are, at the end of the day, and this goes back to the mercantile era, we are a trade interdependent world, you know, globalization. And it's often said in security circles, in fact, I'm going down to Wellington to a security forum, and it's often said that threats these days are no longer foreign and domestic, they are intermestic, that they're no longer global or local, they're glocal. Now, those are silly phrases, but the point is the nature of the threat landscape in the last 30 years has evolved so that there's a considerable overlap between threats of fraud. Trade. You know, New Zealand is a star case of being overly trade dependent on one country. But the fact is, we're all trade dependent in one way or another. There's no country out there, except North Korea, that are completely independent of trade relationships to speak of. And so maybe we can use the soft power, component in trade to push a Southern agenda that doesn't offend anybody, but which better represents the interests of the large number of countries. I don't know for sure if the majority of the world's countries are above or below the equator. I'd have to check that. But I can tell you there's a hell of a lot of countries below the equator. And we may not all be run by decent people, but even the bad guys understand national self-interest and the need to agree on certain areas of common interest. And so that intertwined may be a way to leverage into the larger arguments about values, about security, and those sort of things.
On that point, Paul, let's call this episode to a close. To those who have been joining us in the live recording of this podcast, thank you for your company. Also to those that may be seeing this on demand or via the syndicated outlets, we welcome you to this and also to next week's program, which we will be coming back and discussing similar type of big global issues. And that will be Thursday, New Zealand time, around midday, which is around about Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the United States. Until that time, thank you again. We look forward to your company in that future. Take care until then. Goodbye.